Back together again with you midweek Wednesday style, March 6, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where I started the show with some thoughts I had on how many progressive media members arrogantly treat the political concerns of those who might disagree with them. Quinnipiac University political science professor Scott McLean dropped by to analyze Nikki Haley's exit from the GOP presidential race. Yankee Institute staffer Andrew Fowler filled us in on a brewing controversy regarding charitable school funding in Connecticut, while Hearst Connecticut media columnist and editor Dan Haar had his weekly update. So as I mentioned to you, I think a couple of times already this week, just to set this here up, this section of the program to kick us off, I constantly have people here at the station, in my personal life, in my professional life, saying, man, how is Trump doing so well? I mean, this guy, between the January 6th thing, between the Georgia ballot thing, between the classified documents case, between what he allegedly did to E. Jean Carroll, between the fraud in New York City, how is at least half of the country, how are they even contemplating voting for this guy? Well, that was on display last night, and we'll get to the postmortem on the Super Tuesday races momentarily. But I woke up this morning, I was stumbling around my condo, waking up, and I saw this clip. There are some websites I check with as soon as I get up in the morning. You know, mostly political sites, some on the left, some on the right. And I want you to hear this, and I want you to give me your reaction to this. Even if you are on the progressive side, because if you're a progressive, if you despise Donald John Trump with all of your heart and soul, and you equate him with Hitler and Mussolini and Pol Pot and Genghis Khan and everybody else, this should make you wince. What I'm about to play for you should make you wince. Now, again, let me go back to the supposition people have here. My God, how is this guy doing so well? Well, let me point out how sometimes it's not exactly what the candidate says, and it's not exactly what the candidate does, but it is being tone deaf. The worst thing you could be, if you are any sort of political candidate, I don't care whether you're running for the Bridgeport Town Council, the New Haven Board of Alders, the Hartford City Council, whatever, Bridgeport City Council, whatever, the worst thing you can be is tone deaf to the concerns of the electorate. And in my business here, the media business that we're all involved in here, and I've been involved in coming up on 41 years in a couple of months, the worst thing that my business can be is dismissive. And the only worst thing you can be dismissive and be arrogant in doing it. What am I talking about? Well, I saw this clip was emailed to me this morning. Now, understand something. This is only, let me see what this is. This is about 14 seconds, right? So you're saying, geez, Paul, 14 seconds of audio or 14 seconds of people on air. You're going to use that to make a point? Yes, I am, boys and girls. Yes, I am. And I want to get your feelings on this. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. The worst thing you can be, especially if you have a national media platform, is be dismissive of how people feel. Now, one thing I've done here on a local platform, who knows, maybe this will be rocketing across the country someday, but on a local platform, you know, I can disagree, you and I can disagree, but I respect what you think. And I have said numerous times over and over and over again, you need to respect where people come from, because most of the time, whether it's immigration, whether it's abortion, whether it's guns, whether it's taxes, whether it's transgender issues, whether it's the military, a lot of times they feel that way because something in those categories have touched their lives. So for them, it is a concern. And the worst thing a politician can do, the worst thing a purported public official can do, public servant, and the worst thing, frankly, any arrogant media jerks can do is to laugh at those. You don't laugh. Now, you can be in a forum and say, that's interesting, perhaps, that those people in that race would vote to that extent on that issue. But you don't laugh. You don't become arrogant, and you don't push people. If you don't like Donald Trump, maybe you should watch what you say about issues, especially if you're speaking on a national basis that will push people into the camp of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump, for whatever reason, has a talent. You may not think it's authentic, whatever. He's got a talent of making people think he cares about them, and he is going to be the bull in the china shop that's going to flip the tables. Now, you're saying, well, what are you talking about, Paul? All right. Last night, there was a panel discussion. Jen Psaki, Joy Reid, and Rachel Maddow. On MSNBC, Jen Psaki, of course, Connecticut native, I think, former White House spokesperson. Okay, she's very good, by the way. Miles better than Kathleen Jean-Pierre is. Joy Reid, she's there. She's got a gig. She's arrogant. Everything is racist to Joy Reid. Everything is racist. The sun rose this morning. Obviously racist. And Rachel Maddow was there, the veteran of MSNBC. She gets paid like $30 million a year to do one show a week. But again, it's not my money. I don't care. So, Jen Psaki, Joy Reid, and Rachel Maddow find out they were given information last night that the top issue, or one of the top issues in exit polling for Republican voters in Virginia was immigration. So they decided to discuss this, and at least in this 14 or 15 seconds, they proceeded to belittle people who thought immigration was a big deal. You ready for this? They actually said that. Said this. Okay? Check this out.
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yes. I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very, very contested area.
Thinking, build
a
wall. Like, what?
Arrogance? Jen Psaki? And then Rachel Maddow jumps in. And Joy Reid.
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yes. I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Build the wall.
Build the wall. Cackle away, girls. You know why people in Virginia probably voted the way they did? 2 weeks ago in Virginia, an illegal alien from Venezuela was arrested and charged with sexually assaulting a four-year-old girl in Campbell County, Virginia. He had crossed illegally into El Paso in September of 2023 and was released into the U.S. by the federal government and by the Biden administration.
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue.
Yes.
I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very, very contested area.
Thinking, build the wall.
Like, what?
Can you be any more arrogant? Can the arrogance, can the tone deafness ooze any more from these three women, obviously accomplished, obviously left-leaning progressives, obviously kissing up to the present administration? It's mind-boggling. And again, oh my God, these people in Virginia, why do they care about immigration? Again, I'm reading the report here. 2 weeks ago in Virginia, an illegal alien from Venezuela was arrested and charged with sexually assaulting a 14-year-old girl in Campbell County. He had crossed into El Paso, Texas in September of 2023 and was released into the U.S. by the federal government.
I mean, if you look at some of these exit polls, I mean, I live in Virginia. Immigration was the number one issue. Yes. I mean, again, these could change in Virginia.
Well, Virginia does have a border with West Virginia. Very, very contested area.
Thinking,
build a wall.
Like, what?
You wonder why Trump is winning? You still don't get it. Now, is he going to win in November? I don't know. There's news about that, something I said earlier in the week, that they're going to carpet bomb him with money now, and that's probably the Dems' modus operandi here. And I get it. They're sitting on about $200 million. It's going to buy a lot of commercials. But you folks on the progressive side, and I get people who call me here and they hate Trump and this and that. Well, do you understand at least why the race is so close when you hear that? Oh, these people in Virginia, what do they care about immigration? You see how just disgustingly dismissive the left is. The blue state D.C. beltway left is, if you don't see issues the way they do. Because after all, this 14-year-old girl, she was, what's a little rape of a sexual assault of a 14-year-old girl by an illegal? Come on. We need those people to cut our hedges. You know, the uber progressive, the white suburban progressives, we love those people. Because they'll do our lawns and they'll cut our hedges. A 14-year-old gets raped allegedly by one of them. What's the big deal? Mind-boggling, isn't it? That they sit there and they cackle on national television like that. Instead of saying, okay, wow, this is interesting. Virginia, upper income, kind of mid-Atlantic, leaning toward northeast state. I wonder why. Maybe you can, start an educated discussion as to perhaps why people in Virginia felt this way. You know, you wonder on a break there, and I don't watch any more of it because, I don't need the nausea. But you wonder if a producer came up to them during the break and said, hey, not for nothing, but maybe this is why. You see this story here about this 14-year-old allegedly being sexually assaulted by an illegal, if I was their executive producer, I don't care how much more money they made for me. I would have said, are you out of your minds? But again, this brings this all around to what I was saying. This is why Donald Trump may win the presidency again. So I don't want to hear about anybody, oh my God, we're going to lose democracy. We're going to end up like Nazi Germany. Well, when you're dismissive of the concerns of at least half of the country and say, oh, what is wrong with you? Why do you care that a young girl was sexually assaulted allegedly by an illegal? Well, and you wonder why Joe Biden and Donald Trump are in statistical dead heat. It is mind-boggling. Or maybe it isn't. Maybe Ms. Psaki, Ms. Reed, and Ms. Maddow actually showed what the left was all about last night, maybe. What do you think about this? If you're a progressive, you okay with this? Does this explain anything to you? Do you have friends and, oh my God, I can't believe Trump may win again. Well, have you seen this stuff? Or do you keep your heads buried in the New York Times? Or the Atlantic or the New Yorker, where they don't talk about this stuff. But let's get a little local angle here on the fact that Nikki Haley this morning dropped out of a long shot bid to win the Republican presidential nomination away from Donald Trump. Guy I've talked to over the years, Quinnipiac University political science professor Scott McClain joins us. It's been a while. Scott, how are you, my friend? How you doing?
Very good, my friend.
Everything good on your end?
I think it's just fine. we've got down to a two-man race in the presidential contest, and I think that we're ready to really get into it.
What did Nikki Haley, Scott, if anything, gain from this? Now, from what I heard and read, she's not endorsed Mr. Trump, maybe on the advice of people. They probably told her to hold off on that. But Is she done, Scott, in Republican politics, or is she positioning herself, do you think, for an eventual I told you so here? What about her future before we get to Trump?
Never underestimate the importance of the feeling you get when you can say, I told you so.
Mm-hmm.
It's also not a very constructive thing either. I'm not sure that she has opened up opportunity for herself in the future or someone else. She may have just decided that it's too important to simply think of her own future. I saw that pivot in New Hampshire, mm-hmm. where using her terms, she was kicking sideways to kicking forward.
Yeah.
That being more direct in her critique of Donald Trump and his chances of winning. I think that, you know, she made the decision that it doesn't really matter what her real future is, that she had decided she's going to do this and see it through as far as she could. And she has. That last night was her last stand, and that's the end of her campaign.
It is amazing, Scott, and you probably see some of the stuff and hear this too, being the observer you are. And I have a lot of friends of mine politically involved that I'm friends with on social media. So I kind of try to keep an ear to the ground because of, you know, what they say and they don't say doing a show like this. And the perception of Nikki Haley from somebody who was a very strong up-and-coming Republican governor who has a pretty conservative record, a former U.N. ambassador. She seemed to be the total package, and yet I'm seeing her called a globalist. She's a Democratic
right.
tool. Doma, she's a deep stater. It is amazing, Scott, or is it that anybody who's not a MAGA Republican now is considered the enemy? I mean, Ronald Reagan must be spinning in his grave right now.
I don't think Reagan would meet the standards necessarily today either. I think you're right. Nikki Haley had just about the perfect resume to be the Republican nominee for president about 8-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the party has moved on so quickly. It took Donald Trump in 2016 almost into May before it looked like he would definitely win. He's done it a lot faster this time,
mm-hmm.
and with barely any resistance or challenge. Nikki Haley is not the same kind of challenge that he faced from Rubio, for example, 4 years ago, or Ted Cruz 4 years ago. It's a different kind of party. So maybe Nikki Haley is setting herself up for a chance at a run if the party really changes.
Mm-hmm.
If it changed that fast to be a more strong Trump party, it might take a devastating loss or something really major happening, and it could switch back to what it was. I kind of think it won't switch back anytime soon, though.
Quinnipiac University political science professor Scott McLean joining me. I've talked with Scott for years. Scott, you know, I keep telling people, and as I talk to people on this show and shows I've done, you've talked to me at other stations, and I was doing some of those other shows at the beginning of the whole Trump thing. There's a reason, Scott, and I'm sure you discuss this with your students too. There's a reason people vote for Donald Trump. And I urge people to look beyond just voting for the guy. What is it, Scott, about his message? Because I always say if Trump didn't say it, eventually somebody would. And are the Democrats this time around maybe again playing with fire when they don't stop and say, well, let me step back here. What is he saying that's resounding with so many people?
Wow, what a great question. I think there's a lot to that. I think the stage was set for either political party to become much more what you might call populist, right? Anti-establishment.
Mm-hmm.
After 2008, when we had the Wall Street meltdown, and then, only certain people got bailed out.
Yeah.
nobody went to jail because of the Wall Street meltdown. And all of these things, I think that we had the beginning of something called Tea Party, but it went further beyond that with the Republicans. And you saw the rise of Bernie Sanders in the Democratic side and a kind of redefined left wing of the Democratic Party. And I think Trump was just more effective at harnessing the frustration, the anger, the sense that elites don't listen to regular people, that the deck is stacked against them. And, you know, we could go on all day about how to explain Trump's appeal, but he has it. He has the ability to get those people who are very, very upset and to really fire up those feelings of frustration and anger in a way that we've really never seen a politician able to do that. So it's a lot of Trump, but I think that whatever was going on that Trump was able to harness happened around 2008, 2009.
Interesting. Scott McClain, the guest from Quinnipiac. So now here is Mr. Biden, who, look, Scott, and I've gone out of my way to be gentle on this. We've all had parents and grandparents. There's nothing wrong with getting old. We're all going to be there, hopefully later than sooner. You know, people say, well, you know, my uncle's 81 years old. He's sharp as a... Well, your uncle is planting tomatoes and playing bingo. Okay, he's not running to be the leader of the free world here. Is the age thing a danger for Mr. Biden? And also, are the Democrats, you think, Scott, not taking the immigration issue seriously enough?
Let's take the age question first.
Okay.
It's hard to fully understand why Biden at 80, 81 is considered old, while Trump at 77, 78 is not. But I think one reason has to do with the way Biden speaks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always had a bit of a stammer and has a capacity to commit gaffes. But that's been Joe Biden for the last 25 years. I think it just shows more now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what can Biden do about that? Not much. Yeah. I mean, he is old.
Yeah.
But I think what he can definitely do is show that I'm old, but I'm wise. I'm old, but I'm in charge. I'm old, but I can manage government, that it's operating. And I think that brings us to the State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm.
That he has to give. He's going to have to show that he's dynamic and that he's got forward looking ideas and that he can handle the job. And he just has to show it. He can't hide. So that's the only thing he can do is just say, I'm old, but I have the experience and I know how to do this. Mm-hmm. I can handle this job. But he has to prove it. He can't just say it. So that's the State of the Union. That's why the stakes are big there. On the immigration, I think you're totally right. I think the Democrats are coming to this very late, realizing that there is a problem at the border and that something has to be done. You know, the Democrats worked in the Senate for a bipartisan thing that would have done more to deal with the border issue than Democrats have been willing to do for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's changing. And you'll hear Biden talk about this in the State of the Union. So yes, you're right. They need to talk more seriously about it and to take it seriously. But there are other serious things too, right? There's Ukraine, mm-hmm. there's what's going on in Gaza. And finding out where the border security fits within all of that is something that will be quite challenging, I think, for Mr. Biden in his State of the Union address.
All right.
But we'll see.
Yeah, Scott, I'm going to let you off the hook here. I'm not going to have you fire up your crystal ball now. It's still 8 months out. So
Too far away.
Way too far away. So polish it up, but I'll definitely, before November 5th, I'm going to make you fire up the Scott McLean crystal ball, but not today. Quinnipiac University.
I'm your guy, Paul.
Okay, well, listen, just keep that sucker nice and shiny, and I'll let you know when we'll do it. Scott McLean, Quinnipiac University political science professor. Scott, thanks, man. It's been cool, and we'll talk later. All right. All right, we'll get back to open phones in just a bit. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Talking schools for now. We'll also get back to the idea of whether or not this program at least a couple of schools in Connecticut should be expanded, where these yonder pouches is where kids put their smartphones in. They get locked up, and they can't get at them to use till they leave at the end of the day. And apparently the pilot programs have been going pretty cool, and teachers like them, even the students do, most of them. But we'll stay on the subject of schools for now, and joining us right now from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, the Director of Internal Affairs, Andrew Fowler. And he's written an interesting story of an issue that I had no idea about was happening here, and I saw the link to it, and you can check it out in the National Review online edition, NRO online. Andy Fowler. Andy, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Doing well, thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. So, Andy, describe what's going on here and the controversy here, because I saw the story and I started to read and I said, okay, this is interesting. I guess this is going on in other states, but it might meet some pushback here. So what is going on here?
So it has actually met pushback. So last session, what the bill is being discussed is HB 5101, which would establish a tax credit for donations made to nonprofit entities that provide educational access and opportunity scholarships. So this idea was pitched last session, and it was in the budget, but at the 11th hour, the state teachers union, allegedly threatened to hold up the process of passing the historic income tax over this issue. So it is controversial, but the idea that if it is passed, this will benefit more than 150,000 children in Connecticut. They mm-hmm. would be eligible for opportunity scholarships. And you mentioned that this type of program actually exists in more than 20 other states, in both red and blue. And it helps, you know, more than 300,000 children have benefited from these programs, and there's a lot of enthusiasm for them. I don't know why it's controversial. It's helped a lot of kids, low income students, to get quality education that they need, and so that's the issue at hand up at the state legislature.
So it seems, Andy, by what I'm seeing here in your story and what I've been able to glean out of this, this is kind of one of the responses that the teachers unions kind of reflexively use, saying, well, if we go ahead with this, this will ultimately siphon money away from public schools. It's the reason they don't like charters and everything else. But you contend the data shows the opposite is true. Is that right?
Right. So, as of right now, these opportunity scholarships, the tax credit scholarships, would not take money away from public schools because they don't rely on taxpayer money. Rather, they're, to quote what I wrote in the article, they are funded entirely with private money.
Mm-hmm.
And so if every scholarship student who leaves a public school, the per capita spending for each student who remains would actually increase.
Sure.
And so I served on the Milford Board of Education for 4 years, mm-hmm. and I was actually in teacher union contract negotiations. And one of the things that they bring up, and rightly so, is keeping that student-to-teacher ratio in check, right? You
sure.
don't want to have too many classes because you don't want to burden the teachers, right? And so, there would actually be fewer kids in the classrooms, in the public schools, so the teachers can give them more direct attention. And so you would think that everyone would win because you know, the union right now in their public testimony would say that this would risk that the risk of passing something like this would make the opportunity gaps worse than better, and that the schools actually need more financial support to help with you know, the emotional needs of students. But you know, if we reduce that teacher student to teacher ratio, you know, the students would get more attention, mm-hmm. right? And so by having tax credit scholarships, you know, these kids, low-income students could go to schools that meet their needs to get the attention they need to succeed. And I've been out to these schools over the past few days and the past week or so, and time and time again, I've heard, you know, testimonies from both parents and students about, you know, they felt lost and even bullied in you know, just in these classrooms in public schools, in some public schools, I should say. But that when they got the opportunity to receive the scholarship and choose the school of their choice, they got the attention they need, and they're getting the grades that they need. Because, you know, Paul, also, everywhere is experiencing chronic absenteeism,
sure.
right? And again, if there is that more direct one-to-one, that limits the chronic absenteeism. So that's what we're hoping for with passing, with the legislature potentially passing HB 501, is to help get low-income students the chance to fulfill their full potential.
Yeah. So
we want bigger and better.
Yeah. So Andy, if just to understand how this works, maybe to explain it to my listeners, if I have 10 grand and I want to donate it, so under this, and I guess the way it works in other states, I could make a charitable donation to, say, a charter school or a private academy, hoping that that would help fulfill the mission to help kids, and then I'd be able to get a tax credit on it. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah. So, by donating money, you would get, a tax credit for it.
Mm-hmm. On the state level. So that would go toward my tax liability, say, with the state income tax.
Right. And we've seen in other states that this, by providing that tax credit, that more giving happens. You know, there I have some data that's linked in the National Review
mm-hmm.
article
yeah.
that I posted. And again, you know, the impact is great. I mentioned an example that Arizona, when they passed a similar policy in 2009, there were only 114 students who applied or participated in that program.
Sure.
But, you know, last calculated in 2022, it's well over 1,300. So there is a need, right? That's what we've seen, that that there's a need to provide students with an opportunity to achieve their dream and to potentially break the cycle of poverty. You know, that's what we're concerned about. We want students to be able to achieve their dreams.
So,
and we hope that the legislature will be dream makers and pass the legislation that's before them.
What is the bill name on this again, Andy? The bill number?
It is HB. It's HB 5101.
All right, HB, I'm writing that right down now, 5101. All right, we'll keep an eye on this, an opportunity if you folks wanted to make a charitable donation to a school that may be outside the public school system to create opportunity scholarships to maybe, as Andy said, get kids out of some failing public schools or get them where they need the attention to achieve. And in thanks to that, you would get some sort of a tax credit on your state taxes. Interesting. Andy Fowler, Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Andy, I'll keep an eye on this, and you've got my number, and you can always give me a call and keep us up to date as to what's going on here, okay?
Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Appreciate it, Andy. Thank you. It's the middle of the week. It's the 5 o'clock hour, and that means we talk with Hearst Connecticut Media editor and columnist Dan Haar. Mr. Haar, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. Great to be here. How's everything?
Oh, I'm living the dream, Dan. I always say when I get up in the morning, all my limbs work. I'm living the dream. Hey, the day after we talked last week, you hadn't posted this yet, and now you did last Thursday. And I actually saw this story. I didn't get a chance to read it, I'll confess. I just read it a little while ago. It's a long story. It's a great piece of reporting by you. And I'll put it on our station Facebook page. But I want you to tell the people about this and urge them to read it, because this is about a woman, Dan, who lost a house in the area here that, I mean, she had a credit card debt, but it wasn't a cataclysmic debt. Give us just a summary of this.
Yes, this is a woman who's a grandmother of eight in Bridgeport and a teacher in the schools there. And she had a house for 27 years and was evicted from the house. And there are two lessons in this. The first is she ignored years of summonses to appear in cases. There was the original. There was an $8,831 judgment against her for a credit card debt that may or may not have originally been hers. She may have inherited it from her husband, who passed away in 2006. So the first issue is that she did not get a lawyer to represent her. She tried to represent herself and failed. And even that was, she didn't even join the case until after the foreclosure case was almost 6 months old. So she was close to losing the house when she first reappeared in court. But really, the other thing is that the system allowed this multi-step process to come and take her house. Even if she never appeared, it shouldn't be, because the judge was sort of obligated to take each step as it came. For example, there was and this is the crucial example, there was a $175,000 assessment on the value of her house, not assessment, I should say appraisal, on the value of her house by the credit card collection agency that was suing her. And that same week, the city of Bridgeport valued that same house for $276,000, $101,000 more. And the difference means that because the first assessment would have left her with no equity, by the time they paid back her mortgage, another lien, and the credit card lien, money would be out. Therefore, the judge under Connecticut law ordered what's called a strict foreclosure, meaning just take the house, credit card company.
Wow.
And so they did. And then 4 years later, they sold the house for $365,000. Right. So clearly the house was worth more than $175,000. Or at least it would appear to be worth more. And yet, under Connecticut law, the judge really wasn't allowed to question that. Pansy Wright, the homeowner, could have questioned it in court, but the judge can't step in and question it. So lots of questions raised about how the court systems work, and you know, the obvious lesson, don't represent yourself if you're about to lose your house.
Yeah, and so I'll post this, but that's the lesson, folks. You got to read. It's a great story by Dan here. Yes, we know lawyers cost money. They have to eat, too, but you can't represent yourself in this stuff. Get a lawyer, figure out a payment plan, because you don't want to lose a home over essentially about a $9,000 debt. All right, from that we go to now. Are these the same thing, Dan Haar? You sent me a list. The legalization of psilocybin and another effort to tax the rich. Are these joined at the hip or not?
Under the proposal, if you make more than $1 million, you have to either pay an extra 0.5% or produce a certain amount of psilocybin mushrooms. No, those are two different proposals. The legalization of psilocybin was heard today in the Judiciary Committee, and they heard from proponents, one of whom is the head of the local Connecticut group that's trying to get this done, is a 27-year-old young man who believes or claims that the therapy that he received on the magic mushroom, psilocybin, hallucinogenic mushroom, call it what you will, was worth, you know, 10 years of addiction therapy.
Wow.
Really worked miracles for him. And you hear those stories. And, of course, across the country, you are seeing research, not just research, but practice,
mm-hmm.
showing that some people do benefit from some guided use of psilocybin.
So Dan, what and so in other words, what for people who aren't following this as closely as you are, the legalization of such for medical use, use by doctors or use by regular citizens, would they grow mushrooms? Would they buy this stuff? What exactly do we know? What exactly the legalization would encompass?
Yes, that would be it would legalize a very small amount, which would essentially amount to a few doses. In other words, it's unclear to me how, mm-hmm. whether it would create a market like cannabis. I don't think it would. Provisions would include possession limits of up to an ounce of mushrooms, right? So an ounce is, it depends. The weight, see, mushrooms, unlike a lot of pharmaceuticals, legal and otherwise, or for example, cannabis.
Yeah,
you can relatively gauge the strength of cannabis based on the weight.
Mm.
It's not so easy with mushrooms. An ounce of mushrooms can be X amount or Y amount, depending on what's in them and how they're grown. So that's the one potential danger of this. The other potential danger is that like alcohol and cannabis, you really can't drive on this stuff. But unlike alcohol and cannabis, driving on even a very small amount is really, really bad.
Yeah.
Because its entire point is that it sort of plays with your perception of reality, and so that's a major fear. And you know, creating a market would be a great difficulty. It's not like cannabis where you go and buy. It's just a different type of drug.
Oh, sure.
You're using a lot less of it.
Yeah, and obviously the cannabis is so specifically grown now that you can say, hey, what level THC do you want? All right, I want that, something mild or whatever. Finally, Dan Haar, we are, as the dust is settling from Super Tuesday, kind of what everybody predicted. What do you think Mr. Biden will say, or should he say tomorrow night? Because, you know, you and I are reading this. Everybody's reading this. Well, now that the dust is cleared, it's Trump v. Biden, too. Here comes the big jump, the restart for Joe Biden. What is he going to say? What should he say?
Well, what he should and he will do is lay out the accomplishments of his administration in the form of the infrastructure bill, the inflation is way down. The U.S. has had the lowest experience of inflation of any industrialized country. Certainly the Eurozone countries have significantly, or in some cases significantly, higher inflation. I think he can talk about the U.S. finally getting a little bit more into renewable energy sources and other sort of forward-looking ways of thinking about what the government can do. You know, he's done a lot of good, his administration, and he can talk about that. And that's what he's going to do. The economy is nothing short of a miracle. I get that there are people who say the economy is lousy, but there are always people who say the economy is lousy,
mm-hmm.
because that's the nature of the economy. It's always lousy for some people. One thing that has happened in recent years under both Trump and Biden is that the difference between people who are successful and not successful has widened. But the opportunities for people who are, have education and work hard and so forth have been strong under Biden.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to really talk about all these aspects of his record. He may talk about Trump. I think it would not be a good idea for him to talk about Trump and his personality and his legal issues. He may hint at it. I doubt it. Like a lot of Democrats who look at the polls, they wonder whether he will in fact run. He's not going to get out before the primaries because it's too late anyway. Even if he were to get out today, his name would remain on primary ballots.
Yeah. And Dan, I'll leave you with this. I get emails from an offshore betting place in Antigua. Now, I don't bet. I'm not a betting guy. But this place, they do a lot of political bets, okay? And I know you have a sports background, too, from past years. So you may be interested to know, Dan Hart, that the over-under mark, I'm not making this up. The over-under mark for the length of Mr. Biden's speech tomorrow night is 6.
Oh, Tommy, wait.
Okay, go ahead.
The over-under.
Yeah.
He's not as long as Clinton. I'm going to say 58 minutes.
Not bad. 69 minutes and 30 seconds. 6-9, okay. 30. All right. So, Dan, if you've got a couple of dollars, you know, burning a hole in your pocket, just to let you know. There you go.
I think he's going to go under because, he's, you know, he's a little older. And
okay, so
an
I'll remember that. So, folks, if you're betting on this side in Antigua, Dan Hart says take the under. We'll see.
An hour is a long time.
All right,
have
Dan.
Have a great week.
You too, buddy. We'll check last week. All right, check with you next week. Yeah, there you can actually bet that, folks. So Dan Hart said, what, 58 minutes? This betting site says 68 minutes and 30 seconds.